101.
Quiet, please. Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air. Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network. Lars. And now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday, and we've got a story of corruption going on in one part of the Pacific Northwest where self-dealing by people in public office is actually appearing to put some money in their pockets. And whose expense does that come at? It comes at the expense of ordinary citizens who pay their taxes, and they expect the government to serve them and not for government officials to serve themselves. I'm going to talk about this, and we're going to afford an opportunity, if he chooses to take it, to one of the central characters here, Representative Greg Smith. And in fact, of course, you've heard Greg Smith's name before, because this would not be the first time that Representative Smith has been accused of self-dealing or doing things with his government position that actually put money in his own pocket. And by the way, he's a Republican, so consider that. Glad to have you on board for a Wednesday. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it happens right here on the Radio Northwest Network every single day at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you happen to be a naysayer, we're going to put you right to the head of the list at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And our X poll today: should the government seize any assets of illegal aliens who refuse to self-deport? The federal government will now allow private debt collectors to extract payments from migrants who have racked up massive fines for illegally staying in the United States. That promise came in a letter demanding $1.8 million that was sent to the client of an immigration lawyer. Many migrants, so-called illegal aliens, who have lived in the United States have worked to build assets like a home, a bank account, autos, retirement savings, even businesses. The government's threat to take those assets is likely to accelerate the growing number of self-deportations by illegals. I'll remind you that about a year ago, when it was clear that Donald Trump was the nominee to be president of the United States, at that point in July, it still appeared that Joe Biden was going to be the Democrat Party nominee. We didn't know that the Democrat Party was going to shove him out of the car and into the ditch or under the bus, whichever metaphor you like. And so we didn't know it was going to be Kamala Harris. But no matter, with Donald Trump running, people said he's promising this massive deportation. How's that going to work? And I kept telling you an awful lot of it is going to be self-deportation. And as you, if you haven't noticed the news reports lately, it's happening. So should the government seize the assets of illegal aliens who refuse to self-deport and they owe the government money? I would answer that one yes. You can answer it any way you like. You'll find it at Lars Larson Show on X. You also find it on my website at LarsLarson.com. And always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, in advance, I want to tell you that we have offered Representative Greg Smith a chance to come on this program and explain exactly what's happening. But the news has broken that the Oregon Department of Justice is looking at officials in Morrow County. That's out on the northeastern corner of the state of Oregon. They bought a fiber optic business from a local nonprofit. And according to the reporting of the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper, that's Oregon Live, that they bought it at a low ball price, and then they capitalized on the booming data center business in the small community in Morrow County. And they have generated a windfall for themselves. So I want to tell you why this should matter to you. If you don't know it already, data centers are coming to the Pacific Northwest, both Oregon and Washington. And there are Republicans, even Republicans. I talked to just a few months ago to a state representative in Washington state. Nice young lady. But I said to her, these data centers, they're chewing up an amazing amount of electric power. And already we're seeing electric utilities warn customers, we may have to go to either voluntary conservation or actual blackouts because we're running out of power. Now, most of that running out of power is a conscious choice by the so-called leadership in the Pacific Northwest, the ones who said, shut down the coal plants, shut down every other form of generation, tear out some of the dams, including the proposal to tear out the Snake River dams and dams that have already been removed, and we're going to replace it with wind and solar. And a lot of us said, the math does not work out. There is not enough power. And this nice young lady told me, state representative, Republican Party member, said they're not eating that much power. At that point, it was 6%, but the forecasts are that in the next 5 years or so, the percentage of the power in the Pacific Northwest, which is cheap compared to the rest of the United States, is about 30% is going to be going to data centers to run big computer servers for outfits like Amazon and Facebook and Twitter and other entities that chew up a gigantic amount of power. So what is the accusation being brought from the Department of Justice about these data centers? The civil complaint filed yesterday accuses 8 people, including former officials in Morrow County and State Representative Greg Smith, of exploiting a nonprofit called the Inland Development Corporation, which was founded at the beginning of the century, providing internet access to rural schools, hospitals, and government offices. So what did they do? They bought a fiber optic provider called Wind Wave Communications from the nonprofit. They paid $2.6 million for it, but the DOJ in Salem, this is not the federal DOJ, says that Wind Wave was really worth about $9.5 million, not $2.5 million, almost three times as much as they paid, because Amazon was its biggest customer. But it was a nonprofit. All 8 defendants served on the board of directors of Inland, either before the sale or during the transaction. So, what's happening? Self-dealing. You know, it's funny, there are parts of America where you expect corruption, like Chicago. Chicago is notorious for corruption. Almost all their former governors end up going to prison, whether they're Republicans or Democrats. It seems to be the retirement plan there. But Oregon and Washington have always prided themselves on having this reputation that they run a clean kind of government, that they don't have any corruption. Except in the last decade or so, we've seen huge amounts of corruption. Bags of cash from weed dealers going to state officials, and what appears to be bribery of people like former Secretary of State Shamia Fagan. And now we've got this kind of self-dealing, where you have nonprofit organizations, they end up owning an asset, the asset gets purchased way below its actual value, but it's got customers like Amazon that are willing to pay big amounts of money, and it seems that a lot of the people who run for public office, just like those in the U.S. Congress, and I'm not saying only Democrats, there are Republicans who do it as well, that they want to get in there and get while the getting is good. And I think that's absolutely shameful. In any case, glad to be with you on a Wednesday. If you want to join what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here for the Pacific Northwest at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, for more than a quarter century, we have always gone to naysayers first. We haven't missed a single time. Well, I suppose if we had Donald Trump on the line, which we don't today, but if we had Donald Trump on the line, we might say, naysayer will have to wait in that case. Other than that, naysayers always go first. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote on our X poll. You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
Broadcasting the sound of freedom, here's Lars Larson.
That makes a lot of sense, a lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right, you know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Well, amazingly enough, Mayor Keith Wilson promises to stick with his race-based decision-making down at Portland City Hall. Wilson just sent out a statement promising to stick with the city's diversity, equity, and inclusion standard, even if it costs the city, I kid you not, almost $400 million that it can't afford to lose. Understand that DEI is a politically correct label for racism and sexism. Biased DEI decisions have real consequences for all of the city's more than 600,000 residents. For example, the Rose Quarter project to cover I-5 and create new development land is worth almost $500 million, and they're mostly federal. Portland decided to give exclusive rights to that property to the Albina Vision Trust, a self-stated black advocacy group which promises to grant all the benefits from that project exclusively to black companies and black individuals. Now, does that sound equitable to anybody? Because it sure doesn't to me. So, President Trump has told the city, drop the DEI or lose the cash. The racial bias in the city's decision violates federal anti-discrimination law. That's the basis on which President Trump has said, drop the DEI or you lose the money. Mayor Wilson counters, quote, we are a better city for our diversity, equity, and inclusion. Well, we've asked Mayor Wilson on. He's been on the show one time. He promised to come back. So far, dead silence or crickets from Mayor Wilson. When Keith Wilson ran his private trucking company, I'd be willing to bet that he hired drivers based on their skills and not based on their skin. But City Hall has something toxic and infectious in its water, and it seems that Keith Wilson drank his fill. Our question of the day, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Get better fast. Multnomah Medical Clinic. I withheld the name on this. Lars, my coworkers and I are working in 100-degree conditions. No air conditioning, and they say no hazard pay, but they will give us a popsicle fun. And we have to come and get it from those who have air conditioning. They are comfy in their spot. He said, we are custodians in the Woodland, Washington School District. I got sick a couple of months ago working in this weather, and they tell me, sorry, go to the doctor and no, you have no time off. Figure it out, basically. Laugh out loud. Wow. Well, we're going to put a call into the Woodland, Washington School District. If they haven't heard this report, I'd love to know their explanation. Administrators sitting in air conditioning telling the custodians to work in 100-degree conditions because the school is in air condition, but the custodians are still doing maintenance work. Does that make sense? Now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
Don't stop growing. Well, our Daily Grill goes today, and Willamette Week has actually detailed the story. If you thought the socialist who is the odds-on favorite for New York City mayor is bad, that's Mom Donnie, and the socialist running for the same job in Minneapolis, that makes it worse. Consider what Willamette Week reports on the Portland City Council. No major U.S. city has elected socialists as one-third of its city council except Portland, and 6 months into the new body's reign, a dozen City Hall observers say Portland's agenda and discourse is largely being driven by a block of leftists on the council, and at its heart are the Democrat Socialists of America. Our email of the day, you can send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Cap Concrete Coatings. Turn your garage, patio, or driveway from ugly and rough to beautiful and tough. They did it for me. It is beautiful. Check out CapConcreteCoatings.com or 855-CAP-THAT. Chris writes in, Lars, ODOT came out with a mandate to redo all the crosswalks in Oregon and in every city. If you check with every city manager, their sidewalks are being redone in every city. And to tell you how silly it goes, in Dallas, Oregon, we just got new crosswalks put in 3 or 4 years ago. ODOT came in this year and tore them all out and put in brand new ones that looked almost exactly like the old ones. And to make it worse, once they finished, something wasn't done right. They came in and tore parts of them out and redid them again. I wonder how many millions were put into crosswalks in Oregon to cities that really didn't need them. I'd be interested to know who secured the bid for all those crosswalks. Now, I want to go from that to Representative Anna Scharf, who joins me now. Anna, you got a chance to hear the Northwest nonsense. I won't ask you about that, but feel free to comment if you're so inclined. But you are the lone no vote in the House of Representatives among the Republicans voting against the idea of the jock tax to pay for a Major League Baseball stadium. Welcome to the program, and tell me about that.
So actually, I was the lone no vote on a Senate resolution or House resolution honoring the Portland Trailblazers, and basically the legislature getting on their knees to beg them to please stay in Portland and not relocate. 2 days prior to that, we voted on the jock tax. I voted no on those, but both of them. But I was the lone no vote on the House resolution to beg the Blazers to stay, and not because I don't like the Portland Trailblazers. I think they're fantastic. But because we had voted on the jock tax 2 days before, I knew that what would be coming down the pipe next would be the new owner, whoever they may be, of the Portland Trailblazers, saying, hey, we want the same thing too. We want a new arena, or we're going to pull up stakes and move our team someplace else.
And you knew that would be the threat, because, Anna, I have worked my tail off the last few weeks with everybody and their brother telling me, no, Lars, the Major League Baseball stadium, it's going to be paid for by magic money that comes from the players. And I said, no, this is money that all the, and I use the Blazers as an example. I said, well-paid Portland Trailblazers ball players pay huge amounts of taxes, probably millions collectively, in income taxes, and the money goes to Salem. But the Major League Baseball folks want to divert that money to pay for the effectively the mortgage on a new Major League Baseball park. And as you, and even now, the Daily Dead Fish rapper, the Oregonian, is saying, why don't we do the same thing for the Portland Trailblazers? You were right to suspect that's where they're going.
That was exactly what I knew it would happen, which is why I was the only no vote. And I don't do that. When you're the only no vote in the House, you get the Liberty flag for your desk. And I don't do that just to get the flag. I do it because I knew what the next ask would be. And the irony to this is, can you see the legislature voting to give tax breaks for payroll incentives to build a brand new sawmill where we were going to pay sawmill executives the same salaries that Blazers and baseball players make, and we wouldn't take in their salary, their revenue, into the general fund for however many years to build the sawmill?
No, we're not going to do
absolutely
it.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Private business is private business, and it should not have taxpayer incentives in order to make it happen.
And by the way, I keep telling people the average MLB owner is worth $3 billion. The richest one is worth $20 billion. The poorest one is only worth $1 billion. And they all buy these teams to make money. So I say, why are you saying to a billionaire, we'll pay for part of your stadium, we'll end up owning it, we'll have to take care of it, and you get to make the money from it? Does anybody think that that's a good deal? I'm glad to see that you're against it. I hope you persuade your colleagues. Any last thought?
No, thanks for what you're doing, Lars. Keep up the great work.
Thank you. And that's Representative Anna Scharf. She voted against the resolution that would have said, please, to the Blazers, please stay. I'd like to see them stay, too. They need to pay their own bills. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. You're listening because you like what you hear, right? Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And as usual, the Portland metro area is making, well, they're making history, because nowhere in America is a full one-third of any major city, has its city council more than one-third of socialists. But in Portland, they've decided to go that way. In fact, Aaron Mesh is the managing editor at Willamette Week. Aaron, we're even outdoing Seattle. I mean, they used to be proud of the fact that they had Shama Sawant as their sort of lone socialist, their token socialist on the city council. Portland's got a third of its city council occupied by DSA members. What does that mean for the city?
Well, I mean, I think we're still trying to figure out what it means for the city, but certainly it is a significant shift to the left that happened rather quietly, I feel like, in the last election. There wasn't a lot of fanfare when this took place, but I think you're already seeing the effects on city council, which is that there's a new skepticism of economic development. There's a hostility to police. There's a general feeling that taxes are the solution to, if there's everything. A nail, that's the hammer.
Yeah. Well, and by the way, Aaron, you know, all of this came about because they expanded the city council from 5 to 12. They went to ranked choice voting. And I think it's Richard Cheverton I have to give credit to. He calls the members of the council 25 percenters because not one of them got more than 25% of the actual votes. Is that also accurate, do you know?
Well, I don't think that's correct in the sense that I think that some of them got more than 25% of the actual votes, but they only had to get 25% of the actual votes. So he's correct in the sense that that the way that it works is it's first a 25+1. I think that some members of the council, in fact, did get a higher percentage than that, but his basic concept is on the money.
Well, and I guess if you take it from that, you say we want the folks who voted in ranked choice voting. I don't vote in Portland anymore. I used to, but I vote in Washington State. And when they said, well, we want to have a more representative council, so we want to have 12 members instead of 5. We want them to represent districts. We want them, elected by ranked choice voting. All of this was supposed to make them more representative of the city. Are all these policies that they're espousing or that you see coming down the line from this council, is that more representative of what Portland actually wants right now?
Well, it's a really good question. I think we're going to have a much better sense of that after the 2026 elections. I think that there is a strong base for the DSA, and they have a very good ground game. And there is a portion of the city of Portland that would like to see much higher taxes on the highest earners and more government services. And whether or not that is the same thing that the entirety of the city wants is a question that I think will be more clear when their ideas are really on the ballot in 2026. I think there's the degree to which people didn't quite understand how powerful the DSA would end up being at city council.
I guess what I wonder about, Aaron, is people may want all these things, and they may say, and the way we're going to pay for them is we're going to tax the high earners. Except aren't the high earners fleeing away from Portland right now in a way that's almost unique in the country?
Well, this is the question that vexes Governor Kotek, who has spent much of the last 6 months urging Multnomah County to either cease or reduce collection on the preschool for all tax, which was, by the way, a brainchild of the DSA. So Kotek's argument is that, in fact, the tax is causing people to flee because they can live elsewhere and not pay it. All you got to do is move across to Washington County and you're not paying that tax. Or move to Vancouver or Washington, and you're not paying that tax, plus a bunch of others you aren't paying. So, like, there's plenty of reason to think that that's the case. I have seen studies that say both things, although the data that I trust the most is from Metro and Multnomah County itself, which does suggest that we are seeing a decrease in the number of highest earners.
Okay, and if you accentuate that by raising the tax on them, what I'm concerned with is, you're saying to the bulk of the voters, many of whom pay almost nothing in federal taxes, they may pay very low state taxes. There's a little bit of progressivity to Oregon's tax system, not much, but there's a little bit. So the people who aren't paying much say, yeah, make all those other people pay more and they get to buy all the things that we want. You might get a majority of that unless they think about the long-term consequences. When the people who are paying the higher amount say, I'm tired of this, and they walk away, I almost think we end up like either New York City or California, where California has 1% of its population that pays 50% of the bill, and they're leaving. And when they leave, that bill is going to fall on someone, and whoever it falls on is probably also going to say, I think I'll leave. And then pretty soon you have a group of people who say, we wanted all these things, we figured out who would pay for it, and then they all left, and we got stuck with the bill, and it collapses.
Well, what worries me actually isn't that we would turn into New York City. I think we should be so lucky if it turned into New York City. What worries me is that New York City has a lot of things to recommend it, right? That there are a lot of reasons why you might decide that it's worth living on Central Park, even if it's more taxed than, say, Florida or Arizona. There's a lot of good reasons why you would want to live in that location. I think that Portland has beautiful mountains.
Yes, and you can see those beautiful mountains just as well from one side of the Cascades as the other side?
I think the reason why I stopped speaking is because you're going to have to tell me what else we would have that would cause someone to stay here if they're being taxed heavily.
Yeah, I can't think of it. And especially because there seems to be no regard for, well, who's making the jobs? And that isn't going to be just the Phil Knights, you know, the billionaires. We're down to one billionaire, I think. But it's going to be the middle class folks who run a small business. And if that small business makes a few $100,000 a year, not necessarily in profit that goes into the owner's pocket, but he's told you're going to pay taxes on all of this stuff and we're going to beat the daylights out of you, then that small business owner might just say, then I'm pulling up stakes and I'm leaving. And I don't think people have thought through that possibility, especially the DSA. I'd love to have a DSA rep come on and explain to me how all this is going to work, because it's not working in other places in America, and it's not working in other places in the world.
Well, I would get my popcorn out. I would love to watch you debate Mitch Green, for example. That'd be fun.
I would love to have him on. And and you know, Aaron, as well as I do, that when I have somebody on who's, you know, it's going to be a adversarial interview, I'm on my best behavior because I want to make sure that my behavior does not become the issue. I want my questions to be the issue. But I just wonder if they've thought about the long-term consequences. But then I look at New York and Mamdani's success there because he's the odds-on favorite to win as mayor. And you say, have you thought about what this guy promises to do to the city? And they all say, yeah, isn't it cool? We get to have him as mayor and he's a DSA. Okay. And I think sensible people head for the exits.
It is a possibility that they will. I try not to predict the future too much on this show because if you'd asked me 10 years ago who the president of the United States would be, I would not have expected it to be who it is.
And so, if I'd asked you 10 years ago, how much do you think you'll be able to buy a almost $400 million building for? And if I said, oh, you'd probably be able to pick it up for a tenth of its cost, would you have told me I was being sensible?
I would have started trying to, like, put my salary into a little fund to buy Big Pink.
I mean, imagine that. $9 million a floor 10 years ago, $1 million a floor this month. And isn't that amazing? You can read the whole story at WWeek.com. Aaron Mesh is the managing editor at Willamette Week. Coming up in a moment, Jeff Merkley, U.S. Senator, and not the sharpest tool in the shed. He says that Donald Trump's death toll now counts in the millions. That's next on the Lars Larson Show. When it comes...
Simply by listening, you're proving how smart you really are. Lars thanks you.
Senator Jeff Merkley here. The estimated death total from Trump's policies is now estimated to be in the multiple millions.
Yeah, that's Jeff Merkley, and I got to tell you what he's talking about. He's saying Donald Trump has killed millions of people. Well, let me explain, because like most things that Senator Merkley, or Senator Berkley, if you prefer to call them Matt as I do, is talking about. What is he talking about? Donald Trump has killed millions of people. Berkley goes on to explain that what he means is the cut that the U.S. Congress just voted through. Donald Trump wanted the cut to happen, but it was the Congress that voted it through. That was decided last night, was to cut $9 billion out of the federal budget. I realize that it falls short of the $2 trillion that we are running short of paying for the federal government. They take in about $5.5 trillion a year. They spend about $7.5 trillion a year. We're about $2 trillion in what Washington, D.C. calls deficit. That is, how much more are you spending than you actually take in tax revenue? But They cut $9 billion, and I believe that these rescission packages, as they're called, it's kind of like that old advice about how do you eat an elephant, and you say one bite at a time. Well, the first bite came out last night, and because it passed, it means we can probably expect to see more bites in the future. In fact, if Donald Trump started sending a once-a-week rescission package to the Congress, I would not be disappointed. In fact, what a rescission package is, yes, the U.S. Congress has passed a budget for the federal government. And now the president and his team put together cuts of, why don't we cut this? Why don't we cut that? It's kind of a bass-ackwards way of going about budgeting. It would be like telling the family, I know what you all want. You want a nice house. You want two brand new cars. You want three vacations a year. You want all that. Let's put it all in the budget. And then we'll sit down and decide what we pull out of the budget when we find out how much we have overspent our income. That's the way they're doing it. Now, would I prefer that the U.S. Congress actually went about budgeting a sensible way? And what would sensible be? They used to do 13 separate budgets. There'd be a budget for the Pentagon. There'd be a budget for Homeland Security. There'd be a budget for the Department of Ed, which ought to be done away with altogether, in my view. There'd be a budget for Health and Human Services. And each one would be a separate individual budget, and they'd vote on them one at a time. The U.S. Congress seems completely incapable of actually making decisions that way. Now, maybe someday, if we get a very sizable Republican majority, we can go back to what they call regular order. They've been off regular order for about 20 years. But until we get to there, doing it this way, well, it's better than nothing. You know, to say, let's decide what we can cut out of the budget. So Merkley is unhappy that of the $9 billion in last night's rescission package passed by the Congress, Trump will happily sign it. $8 billion of it went to USAID. Remember the agency that most Americans heard about for the first time in the early part of this year? And they said, what is this USAID thing? It was an idea that was arrived at about 60 years ago by President John F. Kennedy. He signed an executive order. It was later put into law by the Congress. And what did it do? In theory, what USAID did was they went to the poorest countries on the planet, places where sewage got mixed with your drinking water, there wasn't enough food, there wasn't enough shelter, and they said, let's help these poor people out. Let's give them a hand up. That was the idea. What did it become? It became an agency that gave hundreds of millions of dollars to Chinese virus research in a lab in China that we all know the name of now, the Wuhan Institute of Virology. It gave money for all kinds of crazy things, diversity plays in some country, CRT, all kinds of crazy political stuff. And when it started to be cut back, most of us said, that's fine. Merkley is saying that there's a new report out that says if Americans don't pay millions and millions or billions of dollars, that somewhere on the planet there will be a child who dies of starvation. Well, I would guess in theory, if that's true, it'd be like this. Many of you might be familiar with an agency called UNICEF. I don't like the United Nations. I don't particularly like any of their agencies. But the idea of UNICEF was the United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund, that you'd collect money, you'd give it to UNICEF. UNICEF would use it to feed a poor kid. A kid would be saved from starvation. By that logic, the fact that Americans are not giving up 90% of what they have, because we are some of the richest people on the country, in the world, I should say, that if you're making $30,000 a year, which is viewed as meager wages in the United States, you're in the top 1% worldwide. So by his logic, everybody in America and the government should be shipping all of our cash overseas to help out poor people around the world. That's his logic. And that if you cut USAID because it's turned into a crazy political agency, that somehow, somewhere there will be a child who dies. And Senator Merkley is literally seriously, as serious as Democrats get, seriously suggesting that because we're not willing to shovel billions of dollars into USAID, somewhere on planet Earth, millions of people are going to die. This is what passes for serious thought among Democrats like Merkley. Now, a couple of other things. So ODOT's Megan Channel, She was 6 years at the Rose Quarter Freeway Expansion Project. They spent $115 million and nothing has actually happened other than planning. Well, she's now gone from that position. And I'd suggest that the IBR, the Interstate Bridge Replacement Project, and Greg Johnson, he's wasted about $230 million in the 5 years of planning a bridge, which is not going to get built. And we're wondering, how soon does Greg Johnson hang it up on his six-figure salary and his unnecessary position? You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.
NB Landscapes.
For the
bit, so
in exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars, this is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I got to tell you something. For a long time, the Young Men's Christian Association had a very special place in my heart. When I was a kid, I would go swimming there. It provided all kinds of opportunities for young men and young women as well. And yet they have come a long way downhill, as far as I'm concerned, to a point where they are coming under fire from the American Parents Coalition, who are asking for a federal investigation of how the YMCA is spending hundreds of millions of dollars of federal funds. I thought I'd talk about a reporter who's covering that up close and personal, and that's Carlene Johnson, staff reporter at the Center Square. Carlene, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Lars. Yeah, like you, I had a couple of my kids when they were young do swimming lessons, you know, through the YMCA. Great program, and not certain it's a place I'd want. You know, I don't have any grandkids yet, but I certainly wouldn't at this point be recommending that but environment for swim lessons or overnight camps or maybe anything else.
Is a lot of it that they've gotten politically full-on woke? Because I think about the older lady that I talked to a few months ago who got kicked out of her YMCA simply because she showed up in the ladies' locker room. I believe she's in her 70s. She might be in her 80s. And there was a man undressing there. She complained, and they said, you stop complaining about that. He's allowed to be in the ladies' locker room because he identifies as a woman. She complained again, and they kicked her out. They kicked her out after decades there. What has happened to the YMCA, and why are they doing things that the American Parents Coalition say are actually endangering children, disregarding potential rights, and literally violating federal law?
Yeah, I remember that case you're referring to. Yeah, she's 83 now, and she was 80 when that happened. And it was over on the Olympic Peninsula. And you're right, she complained when she saw a man identifying, I don't know if he was actually going through anything, you know, physically to change his body, but identifying as a woman, overseeing young girls in the locker room. And she complained, and so she earned herself a lifetime ban. So finally, she settled. I think she should have held out for more, but they paid her like $65,000 at the end of May to agree to drop that complaint. But and that's just one piece of it, right? The bigger piece, I think about this, Lars, like people working there. You're going through trans stuff. You're an employee. Oftentimes these people do overnight events, or this time of year, you've got like all day things, right? People drop their kids off at the Y at 7 a.m. They go to work. The kid goes for an all day excursion to, you know, we've got Wild Waves right here in the Federal Way area. And all day they're going to be supervised by, a trans person identifying, say it's a male identifying as a girl, overseeing my little girl in the bathroom, changing into her swimsuit and back into her clean underwear after. Are you kidding me?
Nope.
Not going to happen.
It can't happen. So is a federal investigation of this going to do the good, or should we just go for the jugular and say maybe the federal government should say to these organizations, if you're going to do this to kids, if you're going to put kids at risk of either a gross violation of their privacy at the least, and perhaps sexual assault at the most, then you're not getting a dime until you change your practices, the same way the Trump administration has done with other organizations, saying if you don't want to hew to what federal law says, you don't get the money, period.
Yeah, and you just got to exactly the heart of what this American Parents Coalition and their executive director, Allie Murray, told me. We're going after this from every direction we can. Now, last month they asked the Education Department, Health and Human Services, Housing, to look into YMCA and say, hey, wait a minute, these guys are getting like $660 million federal dollars every year, and yet they're in direct conflict with Title IX on the federal level. Of course, states like Washington and some others that you're quite familiar with don't care what the federal government says about Title IX. They're doing their own thing. But if YMCA is getting that much money, the hope is they're going to pay attention. And now the new salvo this week, as you mentioned, was for the American Parents Coalition to ask Marjorie Taylor Greene, who chairs DOGE, to look into it. And so they haven't gotten any response back yet, but I think there's a flood of these from every state. So you know the federal government's paying attention. It's just a matter of time before the crackdown comes, I think.
I'm talking to Carlene Johnson, who's a reporter at the Center Square. Well, the other thing I wonder about, and Carlene, we haven't seen this happen yet, although it might happen in the next few years or decades. Imagine all the lawsuits you ever heard about the Boy Scouts saying you knew that you had a scoutmaster who was doing X, Y, and Z. And a lot of these lawsuits go back decades. Now, I think there's a whole question to be answered about whether or not somebody can adequately defend something that happened decades ago. All the people involved, for the most part, are dead or gone. But has the YMCA, I wonder, considered the idea that at some point, some little girl is going to grow up into a young adult woman and say, my psychological problems all stem back to that transgender YMCA swim instructor who would watch me dress and undress in the ladies' locker room. This thing's got a liability tail to it that will likely go back for decades.
It is inevitable. There is absolutely no question of that. There's already some litigation filed, and it's slowly moving through at a snail's pace, but similar, as you just said, some girls that have said, hey, wait a minute, you know, I'm in the changing room, and I think that's a boy in here, the maintenance guy or whoever, you know, but at this point, it's all of the momentum has been on the side of the left and the woke movement. It's, I believe, under the Trump administration, beginning to slowly turn back the other direction. But in the meantime, I would not recommend any parents have their kids doing an overnight camp with the Y, because that camp counselor in the room with your daughter could very well be a boy, and they don't have to tell you. That's the other part. They don't have to tell the parents anything. So be warned.
Well, and you just wonder, why would the parents, are the parents just unaware of this? Or are they aware of it and they say, yeah, I fully subscribe with that idea. The right of that transgender person is greater than my daughter or son's right to privacy.
I doubt that, right? I mean, as you, we've talked about this before, Lars, it's an 80-20 issue, really. I mean, you know, I don't care. You want to, once you're an adult, you know, you're 18, do whatever you want to do with your body. You know, you believe you're trapped in the wrong body, whatever. Have at it. Go for it. But you don't have any right to expose my child, my underage child, to that, especially without my knowledge. It is so offensive. I know there's going to be tons of litigation, as you mentioned, and if the Y doesn't correct this in short order, they're going to lose all that federal funding, just like the school districts, including Washington school districts, are, because they're out of compliance with Title IX and Title VI. And I, in the meantime, I just say, parents, protect your kids. Your little boys and your little girls, protect your kids.
And by the way, I don't know about Marjorie Taylor Greene, but if the government looks at this, if I look at it as a taxpayer and I say, if you want to have a YMCA, have it supported by the community. And if you say, well, the community won't give us enough money, well, then that's telling you the community does not value what you do. And until they do, why would you want to fund something where a community would not support it on their own? If they're not willing to support it on their own, then maybe it should go out of existence. And I say that about the YMCA. That's Carlene Johnson from the Center Square. Back in a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Voter fraud up next.
Just think of him as your concealed carry. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. One of the most frequent challenges I get from callers, and I'm glad for the challenge. They'll call me up and they'll say, do you think the 2020 election was legitimate? And I'll say, no, it was not. And they say, how can you prove that? And I tell them, well, here are the reasons why I believe that it is not valid. And I give them a lot of good reasons. And they say, no, everybody who's smart says it was the most valid election that we've ever seen. And I usually point out at that point, well, there were a lot of states, about 12 of them, that decided to change their election laws in the wake of the 2020 election to address some of the things that went wrong with the 2020 election. Why would those states have changed their laws? And they say that still doesn't prove that there was fraud going on. Well, I've been looking forward to the opportunity because on a regular basis, we run into stories that illustrate just how fraudulent America's voter system is. And the problem is, it's not getting better. A lot of things get better. This is not getting better. And the reason it's not getting better, America is moving more and more toward not in-person voting, whatever form that takes, whether it is vote by mail, whether it is some other system of voting. The fact is, there is less and less chain of evidence. And you say, well, why does chain of evidence matter? Here's why it matters. But before I do that, let me invite you to the show. If you want to join the conversation, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. If you happen to be a naysayer, we'll put you right to the head of the line. Send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com and vote in our X poll. You'll find a daily poll question, a brand new one every day at Lars Larson Show on X and LarsLarson.com on our website. So people will say, well, hold on a second. Where's the fraud? Well, let me give you a couple of examples that have just popped up. In Minnesota, two people have pleaded guilty after flooding local elections offices with fake voter registrations. And when was that happening? Well, that was happening in October of 2020, right before the election that I keep telling you had amazing levels of flaws. Now, I know that there are some people who say, well, but you can't prove fraud. I don't really care what the motivation of the person was who was doing it. If you're engaged in gimmicking the election system, it doesn't matter whether it was because somebody directed you to do it or because you just thought, I want my candidate to win. I want the other guy, in this case, Donald Trump, to lose. The fact is, if you were messing with the election system, consider what was going on in October of 2020. A company called GBI Strategies, which is funded by the Democrats, was caught by local police in Muskegon, Illinois, in Muskegon, Michigan, and also in the Michigan State Police. They had submitted, get this, thousands of false voter registration applications to the county clerk's office. Now, why would they do that? Well, the offices of Democrat Michigan Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson and Democrat Michigan Attorney General, these are the folks who are supposed to be guarding the hen house, and they really are the foxes guarding the hen house. Each of them had investigators working with Michigan State Police on an investigation, and it went statewide. Now, according to the key suspect in the investigation, GBI Strategies focused on what they called canvassing in urban areas of the state. Ordinarily, what that means is you could go out to a neighborhood and say, we have a list of all the people who are registered to vote. We have a list of all the people who aren't registered to vote. Let's see if we can talk people into registering to vote. Well, the Michigan State Police identifies U.S. Senator Gary Peters, a Democrat, and then presidential candidate Joe Biden as the two campaigns that funded the fraudulent voter registration group's work inside of the state of Michigan. So what does that mean? It means that they literally set up in a hotel room. They sat down and they created voter registrations that were not real. They were not factual. And then they submitted them. They would mail them in to the county elections office. And they would say, this is what we're going to do. The Michigan Secretary of State, Steve Simon, he says he worked to identify the false registrations and then report them to law enforcement. Secretary of State said he also partnered with local elections officials, and they went through the voter registration process to find the fraudulent applications. That he says they were immediately flagged and no ineligible votes were cast, assuming that you caught all of them. What had they done? They went to a hotel in Auburn Hills, Michigan, and then they sat down and made the voter registrations and then mailed them in to the county clerk's office. So they did not show up in person. They just simply mailed them in. Now, when they got done with all of this, they are now looking at a more investigation and potentially charges against somebody for this as well. Second example. Two Nevada residents have pleaded guilty to filling out hundreds of voter registration forms with false information. And what they did was they just put information down, registered to vote. Now, if you wonder, well, how do you actually turn that into votes? Well, if you falsely register and put down false information, false names, false signatures, and a false address to send the mails to mail ballots to, then you can imagine how you could take advantage of that. And the fact is that in both Minnesota and Michigan, this same kind of activity was going on, aimed at creating false, non-existent voters who would be sent ballots. That's where chain of custody becomes very important. How did chain of custody work in the old days? Well, about 30 years ago, before vote by mail really took hold in America, if you wanted to vote, you would register to vote, and on election day, you'd go to the polling place, you'd walk in, you'd identify yourself, and oftentimes, they would ask you for photo ID. They would ask you, if you were in the polling book, they'd say, is that your name? Is that where you live? Show us photo ID. Sign the line, and we will mark that one as completed. They hand you a ballot, you vote, you hand the ballot back to them. The ballot is never out of a chain of custody. How does it happen now? Well, you have fake voter registrations that are sent in. They create a fake voter in the registration rolls. LA just had to remove about 1.2 million fake voter registrations for people who had either died, who had moved, or simply did not exist. Judicial Watch had to bring a lawsuit to make that happen. So at the end of the day, what happens? You get people who get a ballot in the mail. Do we know who those people are? We don't. Are they the same person who's registered to vote? Who knows? And then the ballot is sent back through the mails and is received. And they assume they're receiving it from an actual voter. That may or may not be the case. Let's go to Gordon in Everett. Gordon, welcome to the program. You're a naysayer. We're close to the break, so let's get right to it. What do you and I disagree about?
I am a boat captain up in Edmonds area. You said the other day that a car, the ferries can't generate electricity with a propeller.
No, I got an email from a listener who said he understood that electric cars, when they're on a hill, will do some regenerative braking. He said, how much regenerative?
What? So can a propeller, if you don't mind me saying, sir. I believe that going across the Puget Sound back and forth with the wind and the tides could regenerate and
could if and, this, and are the ferry are the electric ferries being built so that when the ferry is being moved, I guess by wind or by current, that somehow the propellers will turn electricity back into the ferry? Because I haven't heard of any of that being installed on the new electric ferries. Has it been?
They must have studied it, or what? Well, they wouldn't have approved this whole thing. I mean, because...
Oh, no, no. They wanted electric ferries, whether they made economic sense or not. And as all of us who've looked at it know, they don't make any economic sense. And Washington State is now having those new ferries built in Florida because they couldn't find a local provider.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's... things you wish you could say. More with Lars.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I love the fact that there are some guests I can ask them about just about anything, and they have some point of view on it. And one of those guests is Leland Vittard, Chief Washington Anchor for News Nation. Leland, how are you?
Yeah, my mother used to say I was seldom right, but never in doubt.
That might even be a Winston Churchill that your mom might have cribbed from him. But let me ask you about that. Why do you think that Donald Trump is so anxious to move on from the Epstein controversy and declares it even a hoax, and that people who are concerned about, well, exactly who Epstein might have been providing little girls for sex to, that this is a hoax and that the people who continue to pursue it are stupid. This sounds like the president tromping on top of his, I guess, most fired up base.
Right. I think the most obvious answer is the right one in this case, which is that the president is very concerned that if the files, meaning emails, correspondence, who Epstein was managing money for, who Epstein asked for favors, who got favors from Epstein, on and on and on were released, there would be a lot of people, namely Democrats who spent a lot of time in New York in the 1990s, who would be implicated in being in Epstein's orbit. Now, you make a very good point. Does being in Epstein's orbit mean that you were engaged in illegal behavior? That is right, and that's the point. And that's what Trump is saying he wants to protect. Look, Trump's figured out his way out of this, which is the special counsel, right? We know how this works, which is he has other people in MAGA world float it. Then he says, it's not up to me. It's up to Pam Bondi. Then Pam Bondi, who is way out over her skis on this and completely fouled this thing up, she appoints a special counsel. Special counsels can't talk to the media because of ethics rules. So it's going to be a 2-year investigation. Mind you, special counsels are meant to investigate new cases, not old cases. The question would be, what is the special counsel investigating? Because the Trump Attorney General Bill Barr under the first Trump administration already looked into whether there were other people to be charged. And conceivably, Merrick Garland, with the conviction of Ghislaine Maxwell in that trial, would have looked into, are there other co-conspirators or people who women were provided for? And they declined to prosecute. So really what this is buying time. It's a pretty smart move.
I guess what I don't understand is the initial release of the information. I mean, it's almost the quintessential, let's get rid of this. Let's dump it out on Sunday night on the 4th of July weekend, a long weekend when most people are not going to be back at work on Monday. Nobody's paying attention. It's the middle of summer. It's a great time politics world to dump stuff and have it paid the least attention to. And I think all of us, and I'm not going to ignore that just because it's Trump and I support Trump. The fact is, I'm concerned that I don't want stuff buried. And the idea that somehow Epstein operated in all these high-flying circles, financial and political, and that he was obtaining girls for sex and violating the law, getting light punishment for reasons you still can't really explain why they didn't do much of anything with the case out of Florida, and he got a slap on the hand, but he appeared to be on his way to getting convicted of some serious charges, and then he mysteriously dies, and his madam goes on trial. And there are even references by some of the witnesses, girls who are now women, who said, yes, she told me that I'd be perfect for Jeff and his friends. And we're never going to find out who those people are because they're politically powerful or politically connected or rich or all three. And so they escape punishment. I think that really grinds on a lot of us. And I'll put myself in that category.
Yeah, I think there's about 3% of America who is satisfied right now with what we have learned about Jeffrey Epstein. So I don't know what else there is to say. I think it will be interesting. What is going to be interesting to me to see is whether MAGA world, yourself included, who I think really are on the side of righteousness right now by demanding answers about Jeffrey Epstein, whether they are satisfied by this appointment of a special counsel that we know what's going to happen. They're going to go on for years and investigate what's already been investigated and say, oh, well, we have found that nobody else was involved in wrongdoing, that we keep, because special prosecutors prosecute. They don't, you know, they don't just fact find. And there you go. So.
Yep.
Are you going to be satisfied with that? Are you going to be quiet about this for the next 2 years?
I don't think so. But, I mean, that's my take right now. Leland, let me ask you about something else. So last night, they managed to get the rescissions packets across the finish line. And I've told my audience, the sensible way to budget would be to actually say, this is where we're going to spend money. Congress doesn't want to do that. They budget a different way. They put a giant elephant of a package together and say you get the whole thing or you get none of it at all, and they managed to get that thing passed. They haven't been in regular order on budgets for about 20 years. But this may be the way to do it the other way. like eating an elephant one bite at a time. You say, okay, here's the budget. And then you start chipping away at it. And last night they took a chip, $9 billion out of it, eight from the despicable USAID folks, and said, okay, and also our friends at NPR, they get cut as well. And I say, okay, that's a start. And since that one passed, are we going to see the Congress and the president propose other rescission packages and start to chip away at these crazy overspending budgets?
Perhaps. I mean, this is the quintessential definition of moving the deck chairs around on the Titanic, okay? These are, we have to be honest with our viewers and our listeners, these are rounding errors. And to celebrate this as though it's some great achievement by the U.S. Senate to chip away $8 billion is really like, you know, us celebrating that we got a free Happy Meal at McDonald's. Okay, really. I mean, that's what the math is.
I know. It's small,
okay,
but
so
it's a start.
We got to be honest about that.
Right?
Well, fine, it's a start, and you could do one of these a day, and it wouldn't make a difference between now and when Donald Trump left office. Okay? Take that back. If you did one of these a day...
Yeah, I was doing the math on that, and I thought Leland's math is off on that one.
Okay, one a day. You do one of these a day, and I don't mean one of the days that the Senate is in session, but one a day actually per day, you might get somewhere. Okay, so this is silly, but what I think the point, and I think Republicans should be terrified about this. They should be terrified about going back on the same thing, about questioning whether or not Joe Biden's pardons are valid, because what is good for the goose is good for the gander. And we have learned in American politics, the next administration will do on to others as has been done on to them.
And when it comes to Joe Biden's pardons, whether real, isn't it a concern if America says we got a screwed up system for choosing the president, but that's how we do it, and then this guy or this gal is in charge, and then we find out he really wasn't running the show at all, which a lot of us suggested for the last 4 years?
Sure. It's very concerning. And what are you going to do about it? Because I guarantee you that if all of a sudden the Trump administration tries to walk back these pardons, okay, that whoever Donald Trump pardons at the end of his term, himself, his family members, members of his administration, whoever that he pardons, okay, Democrats are going to go through the same thing. Just watch.
Well, how about we start with Mark Milley? I think that guy committed treason, and he got one of the pardons.
I don't.
You don't?
But
calling
no,
up the Chi-Coms and saying, I will stop the president from launching a nuclear attack, and I will tell you if an attack is coming. That's not treason.
Well, I'm sorry. Do you know who said that?
Well, I think I can say I'm fairly sure.
No, you don't.
Could I prove it in court? No. Yeah, that's
right.
That's
okay, so if you want to prove something, if you want to accuse somebody of a crime and a high crime, which is treason, let's have a little bit of proof. And I think there is a very big difference between calling up the Chinese and saying you need to understand that America is working through its very difficult time, which January 6th was, which I think the entire world was shocked by what happened, and saying, no, we are not launching an attack against you, you don't need to worry. I don't think it's treason.
Okay, fair enough. That's Leland Vittert, the chief Washington anchor at News Nation. Leland, thanks very much. Back in a moment. You got the Lars Larson Show.
Informed and always guessing what he'll say next. Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And boy, is it hot in the Pacific Northwest about now. And I know that's a concern. And yet some of the responses from local government just seem almost comical to me. I'll get into that in just a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show on a Wednesday. Always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your email to talk at LarsLarson.com. And this segment of the show is brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showings, no hassles, and you pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details. Now, about our X polls. We put up a brand new poll question every day. Yesterday, I asked you based on an email I got from a gentleman up north in the Puget Sound region who gets his power and his energy, both natural gas and electricity, from PSE. That's Puget Sound Energy. And he said he had received a notice that PSE was having a flex event. They've come up with a warm and fuzzy name for telling you don't use electric power if you can possibly avoid it, meaning that from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m., they wanted this customer to not use any major electric appliances, meaning don't use your stove, don't use your washer and dryer, don't run the dishwasher, don't recharge your electric car. And what the gentleman asked me in the email, he said, I drive a gasoline car. I don't have a lot of electric appliances in my home. I heat my home with natural gas. And yet they want me to cut back on the amount of electricity I use because the electric utility has made decisions that make it hard to manufacture enough electric power. In fact, I found it kind of ironic because today, President Trump was signing some documents in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania has coal, and they used to have a coal-fired power plant. I'm trying to remember the town that it was in, but it was called the Homer Power Plant. And no, it's not Homer, Pennsylvania. It's another town in Pennsylvania. And this plant was a massive plant, 1800 megawatt electric power plant. And it generated electric power from coal. And what happened? During the Biden administration, they pressured about four dozen electric power plants to shut down. I think the final number might have been five dozen. It was around in the high 50s, low 60s, the number of power plants that got shut down. And Trump had said, we're going to make sure these power plants get restarted. So what was Trump doing today? He was signing the papers to say that that power plant will be allowed to change over from coal, its former fuel, to natural gas, which makes complete sense. In fact, if you wonder, well, why didn't the Biden administration do the same thing? Change over from coal to natural gas. And the answer is because the green true believers, the ones who say, why the planet is going to come to an end if we don't fix global warming or climate change right now. In fact, you had a bunch of people in politics. Bernie Sanders was one of them who 5 years ago was saying, if we don't fix climate change in the next 5 to 6 years, then it's game over. Well, it's 5 or 6 years later, and yeah, it's hot in the summertime. That's not exactly news to most of us. The fact is, it's not a problem. So Trump was saying you can change this plant over to natural gas, and that's exactly what's going to happen. Instead of simply throwing the plant away, disposing of it, dismantling it, they're going to repower it, not with coal, but with natural gas. And you might wonder, why aren't we doing that here in the Pacific Northwest? The answer is, you had the Boardman coal plant in eastern Oregon. You had the Centralia, one of the two Centralia coal-fired plants in Centralia, Washington. And initially, when PGE, the major owner of the Boardman coal plant, said, we're going to shut it down as a coal-fired plant, they said, then we're going to fuel it with what's called switchgrass, which you can grow in large quantities and then turn it into a kind of coal, you know, except it's renewable and, you know, and all that. So they said, well, we tried it. We can't figure out a way to make it work. Could they have switched that over to natural gas? They could have. Except, as I said, the greenies, for whatever reason, don't like nuclear power. They absolutely refuse to allow more natural gas-fired power, so they simply shut the plant down. And the plant was decommissioned long before the end of its useful life. And what I ask you in the X poll, on the basis of that email I got from the gentleman who's a customer of PSE, who said he wasn't going to cut back his electric use, when the utility companies early in summer are already asking you to voluntarily conserve because otherwise they'll be forced to have blackouts. But all of this is because state officials and power companies have decided to artificially reduce the amount of power they generate. And then they turn to their customers and say, we might have to black out parts of the region if you don't cut back your power use. That is not what the power companies are supposed to do. When you sign up for electric power, when you say, I want to be a power customer, it is the job of the utility, which enjoys a regulated monopoly, meaning they get almost a guaranteed rate of return. In most businesses, there's no guarantee on the rate of return. In electric utility monopolies, state-regulated monopolies, there is. So should Northwest Utilities ask customers to voluntarily not use power to avoid blackouts? I said no to that. And 82% of you joined me in that vote. Only 18% of you said yes. So today's question, should the government seize the assets of illegal aliens who refuse to self-deport when they owe the government money? And the Trump administration plans to do that. They're already out putting pressure on people saying, if you're not going to self-deport and if you have assets and you owe the government money, we're going to come out and we're going to get it, even if we have to seize your assets to make it happen. The X-Poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson.
For the big show.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air. Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails, and I'll do that in just a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we always put naysayers first at 866-439-5255. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can answer our X poll. You'll find that every day at Lars Larson Show and on our website at LarsLarson.com. But I've been telling you that last night in the United States House and Senate, they managed to pass a rescissions bill. And that rescissions bill is going to trim $9 billion from the federal government budget. Again, it's a very small amount of money in comparison to the entire budget of about $7.5 trillion. But I've compared it to eating an elephant. You do it one bite at a time. Let's hope that other rescission packages follow this one. But in the meantime, I thought I'd ask you this. Since Donald Trump has been cutting costs across the broad range of government agencies, from USAID to agencies like the Department of Ed that ought to go out of existence altogether, is it time to start cutting at the White House as well? I thought we'd check in with John Hart, who's CEO for OpenTheBooks.com. John, welcome back.
Lars, it's great to be on again. Thanks for having me.
Is Donald Trump at his own White House living up to the concerns he has about government overspending in other federal agencies?
Well, Lars, there's some good news to share. The White House is actually making a good faith effort to lead by example. So what we've found is that the White House has reduced payroll by 29% year to year. So the Trump administration spent about $44 million on 404 employees in 2025, and that's a 29% decrease from the White House payroll in 2024. The last year Joe Biden was in office, when they spent $62.2 million on 565 employees. So it's a very important step in the right direction. And it shows that a good manager can do more with less. And that's the challenge that every business owner, every family faces every day when they try to balance their checkbook. You're always trying to do more with less. And this White House is leading by example. And the president and the administration deserve credit for that.
In fact, you pointed out that the White House budget has not been this small since 2009.
That's right. Yeah, it's been a very significant decrease from what it has been over, even in the first Trump era. So, you know, it's getting money to go in the opposite direction is like making a river run backwards. And, you know, as I mentioned before on your show, when I worked for Senator Coburn, we actually helped reduce overall federal spending by $150 billion year to year between 2012 and 2013. And that's, again, that's like making a river go in reverse. And so the White House really has taken this challenge and applied the logic that they're applying to other agencies to themselves. And that's a very positive step in the right direction. It's demonstrating good leadership to show the other agencies that they're trying to downsize as well. That, hey, look, we, you know, and as you and I would agree, that there are some agencies that need to disappear altogether, like the Department of Education. You know, there's no constitutional basis for a good amount of what the federal government does. You know, there's over 440 agencies. The Constitution really only describes four, arguably five agencies that exist in our constitutional republic, or that should exist. And so we need to reimagine what the Constitution looks like in the 21st century. I'd call it 21st century federalism, where we shift a lot of what the federal government and the administrative state has been doing over the past 100 years and shift that back to states and local communities. And again, it can only happen one step at a time. You know, when we, at the end of World War II, instead of invading mainland Japan, we did an island hopping strategy where you move incrementally. And that's not very satisfying to people, because I want to see this budget cut over $2 trillion immediately. But having done it on the inside, I know how hard it is to do that. So you have to do it, you know, one step at a time through bite-sized cuts. And that's what the administration is trying to do. And it's very, very important, again, to lead by example.
Well, in fact, John,
it's possible to manage your own office more
quickly. I write a lot, you know, for this show. An awful lot of what I do is ad lib, but I also write a lot. And I always find it's easier to edit than it is to create. So you create a lot, and then you go in and you say, okay, what parts of this are good and what parts can I edit out? And it'll still say the same thing. Is it easier then, since the Congress doesn't seem capable of getting back to regular budget order, where they have 13 budgets for 13 big federal agencies, is it better just to let them pass the elephant and then turn the elephant into a donkey, by cutting it down to size?
Well, I really think that Congress needs to really step up and take leadership here. I think the rescission package was necessary. I think there are times when that can be used appropriately, and I think that was the case when. And the reason is that the administrative state as it exists today, that itself is a constitutional crisis. So this White House has taken on that challenge and said, look, a lot of what we're being told we have to fund is not constitutional. We're willing to challenge that. We're willing to take it to the courts. And when they've made cuts, they've done the appropriate thing and sent it to Congress and said, we have no intention of spending this money. We want you to accept this rescission package. So that really is operating within the constitutional framework. However, Congress really needs to be the one showing leadership. You know, it should be, and to the credit of the House Budget Committee, Jody Arrington wants to do that. He wants to show leadership and give the White House a more aggressive package of cuts. And again, the point I would make to, you know, senators who are upset, and I understand why they're concerned, is the onus really should be on them. If you don't like the set of cuts that Russ is sending over at OMB, then send them your own cuts that are more aggressive and more targeted and reflect the priorities of the Senate, because they're all elected as well. And so that's the system our founders created. So I would like to see Congress show more initiative. But it's a principle of life that you really can often do more with less. And that's what the White House has done. It's been obviously a very effective, very productive, aggressive first few months in office. And we've seen that throughout the federal bureaucracy. And we've asked, you know, CBO to study this for us. And often what happens is when you get rid of or you downsize an agency, you make the quality of services more productive, because you get rid of things that are duplicative and not necessary, that cause confusion and actually hurt the user experience. And so I think this is a success that they ought to build on and they ought to trumpet.
Well, and in fact, when you point out the salaries are a bit bigger, I've always told people, I mean, back when Tony Snow went to work for George W. as his press secretary, and I remember, I think that the paycheck then was about $170,000, which is a lot for an average American.
Sure.
But it wasn't anything like what Tony was making at Fox News.
I didn't know
what he made, but he certainly was. I mean, nobody who was a mainline anchor at one of the major networks was getting by on $170,000 a year. So it may be tough to attract talent. The fact that it's only gone up to $195,000, which again is a lot of money for the average person. But if you went and said, we want to find some top talent from media or other fields, and we're willing to pay them $195, tell you what, you're not going to get much in the way of talent, because an awful lot of law firms bring people in above that as starting associates. That's John Hart. He is the CEO at Open the Books. You can find them at openthebooks.com. Back in a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. We'll talk about President Trump and the Epstein files up next. If you've been...
You know, if we keep meeting like this, people are going to talk. Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I want to spend just a bit of time talking about both the Epstein files and President Trump's response to them. As you know, I'm a Trump supporter, and I continue to be a Trump supporter, although I've always told you, all the way back to 2015, that when I disagreed with Donald Trump, that I would tell you so, and I'd tell you why. In this case, do I think that Jeffrey Epstein was a full-on pervert pedophile who obtained sex from children, girls? And the answer to that is yes. In fact, he was convicted of that crime. So even though he's dead, and I can't engage in defamation of Jeffrey Epstein because you can't defame the dead, I think he was a pervert pedophile. Do I think he was convicted of it once? Did I think that he was going to be convicted a second time? Yes, I did. And was his trafficker, his madam, his pimp, whatever you want to call her, Ghislaine Maxwell, was she convicted of trafficking in children to provide Jeffrey Epstein with his sick sexual fantasies? Absolutely. Now, do I think that Jeffrey Epstein might have done that for rich and powerful people that he liked to call his friends and that he associated with all the time? He made a lot of money by his associations with very wealthy and very powerful people. Now, none of that is a hoax, which really makes it troubling to hear Donald Trump, President Trump, call this a hoax as he did this morning.
You said this was all a hoax. Has your attorney general told you this was a hoax? What evidence have you seen?
No, it's not the attorney general. No, I know it's a hoax. It's started by Democrats. It's been run by the Democrats for 4 years. You had Christopher Wray and these characters and Comey before him. And it's a bad group. It started, actually, look at the Steele dossier. That turned out to be a total hoax. The 51 agents, the intelligence, so-called intelligence agents, it was a hoax. It's all been a big hoax. It's perpetrated by the Democrats. And some stupid Republicans and foolish Republicans fall into the net.
Now, I don't know who he's talking about specifically when he says, you know, foolish Republicans or stupid Republicans are going to fall into the net. I do understand that the Russia collusion hoax was a hoax. It was made up of out of whole cloth in the Steele dossier. It was put together by Fusion GPS and by, you know, with the assistance of the Democrat Party and Hillary Clinton. But what I don't get is when President Trump says Epstein was a hoax, what do we know for a fact? We know for a fact Epstein obtained girls, children, and used them for sex. He was convicted of that in Florida. Although he got very light punishment, he appeared to be on his way to being convicted of it a second time in New York when he died in custody. I refuse to believe that he committed suicide. I think he was killed. And we know for a fact that the person who is accused of trafficking those children, that she was convicted as well. None of that is a hoax. Is it unbelievable that Jeffrey Epstein might have provided children for sex to his friends and associates? Well, we know the testimony of one of the victims of Jeffrey Epstein who testified at the Ghislaine Maxwell trial, a young lady who said she was told by Ghislaine Maxwell, you are the perfect look for Jeff and his friends. And yet the president is calling it a hoax. Listen to this.
I call it the Epstein hoax. It takes a lot of time and effort. Instead of talking about the great achievements, we've had a great gentleman yesterday, as you know, went on CNBC and he made the statement that Trump may go down as the greatest president of all in the United States. And instead of talking about the things we've achieved, we've had tremendous achievement. They're wasting their time with a guy who obviously had some very serious problems, who died 3-4 years ago.
Yeah, and at least we're hearing now that President Trump wants a special counsel appointed not just to look into all the hoaxes run by the FBI and the CIA and the Russia collusion hoax and all that, but that special counsel will look into Epstein as well, and I'm glad to see the president do that. On another subject, one of the potential candidates for president of the United States, and that's California Governor Gavin Newsom, this guy is having a tough time answering questions. In fact, he went on with Sean Ryan, the former Navy SEAL, on his broadcast or his podcast, And he was asked a very simple question, which goes to some of the sexual sickness of America in the 21st century. And that was whether or not an 8-year-old child is too young to make a decision about a sex change. I want you to listen to this because it's a very simple question. And Newsom even admits that his attitude has changed because he has a daughter about that age, and yet he can't, in a minute or two, give a simple answer. Is it okay for an 8-year-old to decide on a sex change?
What about for your values? I mean, is 8 years old too young?
Yeah, I mean, look, I now that I have a 9-year-old, just became 9, come on, man, I get it. So those are legit. You know, it's interesting, just the issue of age, as someone that's been so focused on equality, broadly LGBT rights, particularly gay marriage. Mm-hmm. The trans issue for me is also novel. It's over the last few years. I'm trying to understand as much as anyone else. Whole pronoun thing, trying to understand all of that. Well, you know, that was like, the hell, I mean, all that stuff. I get it. All this stuff started to collapse on us. I joked with Charlie about Latinx.
Yeah, I joked with, hold on, he's changing the subject. The fact is, this guy is going to have one heck of a time running for president of the United States if asked a simple question. Is 8 years too young to decide on a sex change operation? And he can't give you a yes or a no because he's babbling along like he's somehow channeling Kamala Harris, trying to figure out what do I say that's going to keep my LGBTQ base intact while at the same time not giving them the soundbite that will torpedo my entire campaign for president. And then finally this, Zohran Mamdani, the guy who is the Democrat nominee in New York City for mayor. He is perhaps the odds-on favorite to win the election in November. And you will have a jihad, global jihad advocating Muslim socialist as the mayor of America's biggest city. And yet, what does Democrat Pramila Jayapal say about Mamdani?
I think it's hard not to be won over because it's the combination of his authenticity, his smarts, and his commitment to lifting up working people and making life better for real folks that is really inspiring.
His authenticity? If you take a look at this guy's background, you wonder exactly what would he plan to do with New York City other than turn it into a haven for socialists and wreck one of America's great capitalist engines. Now, let's go to Santiago. Hey, Santiago, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Oh, well, I was gonna talk about the Epstein thing, and I can do that, but talk about Zohran Mamdani, too. Anyway, no, I think the Epstein thing is actually, Trump has kind of shot himself in the foot because this was because the whole idea of protecting children and the whole idea of, draining the swamp was such a huge part of his last two campaigns. And now that, because, the photos are out there. We all know that Trump has definitely, he's definitely was a part of Jeffrey Epstein's inner circle.
Santiago, that's, to put up or shut you up, know that's not true, don't you? The photo you're talking about where Trump is at Mar-a-Lago and he kicked Epstein out long before Epstein was convicted of any crimes because Epstein was out getting on teenage girls. Santiago, I'm not going to go where you're going because fact is, it's not true. Donald Trump kicked Jeffrey Epstein out of his club because the guy was going after teenage girls. That's the bad stuff.
The Lars Larson Show. The best investment in talk radio, and it's free. Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. Always glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I saw something amazing happen. I think it was about 10 days ago when governor of New York, that'd be Kathy Hochul, made the decision. She came out and announced she was going to advocate for the construction of a nuclear power facility in New York State. And I thought, well, that's a change because ordinarily Kathy Hochul hews to whatever the Democrat Party is behind. And they are most definitely definitely behind green energy. And if you know anything about that whole business, the greenies hate nuclear and they hate natural gas and they don't want anything to do with either one. And if I'm wrong about any of that, Larry Behrens, who's with Power of the Future, will be happy to correct me. So, Larry, tell me that I'm wrong, that Kathy Hochul has gone from being on the anti-nuke side to the pro-nuke side now.
It's a miracle, Lars. It's an absolute miracle. She has seen the light. I'm sure this election year conversion has nothing to do with the fact that she's going to try to win back her office. I would never be that cynical. No, you're absolutely 100% right.
I mean, that isn't this crazy? It's almost like watching Fetterman go conservative, and all it took for him was a stroke. I'm not quite sure what hit Kathy Hochul in the head, metaphorically or otherwise. But I'm not going to complain if she truly is behind it, or is she just doing it for, you know, publicity purposes, knowing that whatever she advocates for, it ain't going to happen in the next couple of years.
Yeah, whenever you see leftist governors or leftist politicians in Washington like this accidentally trip over the truth, you know it's the polls that have led them there. She can't deny reality anymore. New York has some of the highest electric rates in the nation, and she doesn't want to be held responsible for it, but absolutely make no mistake, if she were to win again, she would feel absolutely unscathed by her previous commitments to try to embrace reality. And so New Yorkers need to remember that. They need to remember what she has done, because that's what she's going to try to tell them for the next year or so. Don't believe what I've done. Believe what I'm telling you now.
Well, and isn't there, I mean, look, nuclear, I've always been a fan of nuclear power, going all the way back to when I was a teenager and I visited my first nuclear power plant. And I thought, this stuff's amazing. And that's technology from 60, 70 years ago. The stuff that they've designed today seems absolutely amazing. And it's amazing to me that most of the United States is not pursuing it while most of the rest of the world is. Can you help put that in perspective for my audience?
Yeah, it's all because of the green movement, right? What has happened with all of this is that they are not pursuing it because the leftists told them not to. The leftists told us for years that emissions are the number one problem, and then you point them to nuclear, and then they say, oh, yeah, no, we're not going to do that either. So it makes you wonder, is it really about emissions or the environment, or is it really about enriching Chinese-made, sun and wind products that will help us not have great electricity, but sure drives up prices on the average ratepayer? And so it is absolutely something to consider. And when we look at something that New Yorkers and everyone needs to be on the lookout for, when we talk about nuclear energy, there are companies and groups that for years have fought to get rid of affordable and reliable power for the rest of us, for ratepayers, and then they go start up their own nuclear facility, and they get what's called behind-the-meter pricing. In other words, they get a special price from that nuclear power, but we also have to pay the consumer price. No, they should have to be on the same pricing grid as the rest of us.
Now, you're talking about all the tech companies that have now announced they're going to do things like fire up part of Three Mile Island again and build their own nuclear power plants. That's the entities you're talking about, the major tech companies, right?
Absolutely. The ones who have, Bill Gates, who tells us that we should try to block the sun in order to combat global warming. That is absolutely right. When it comes to powering his company, well, lo and behold, he wants affordable and reliable power. And so they're going to start up these plants, which is great. They should, but they should be on the same pricing scale as the rest of us, not getting this behind-the-meter special deal, especially after years of pushing, unaffordable and unreliable power onto the rest of us.
I mean, I was trying to imagine this, Larry, because I usually look for a metaphor of some kind. I mean, most of America has fairly good water. You know, there are a few places that don't, and they're kind of notorious. But most of the country has good water, and it comes from wells or it comes from rivers, and there have been a few notable examples like Flint, Michigan. But imagine what would happen if the tech elites in America said, yeah, the water is mostly crap, so we're going to go out and build these special plants so we can have clean water, but the rest of you don't get to drink it. You have to keep drinking the same old stuff you're drinking now. I would imagine the Americans would come unglued, and I kind of expected the same reaction to all these tech companies announcing, we're going to get nuclear. You guys can get your power from wind and solar, which aren't working out very well, but that the big tech giants like Gates and others were the ones advocating for it. I'm kind of surprised by the lack of public response to that.
Yeah, it's such a great analogy. And let's be clear, if wind and solar worked, it would have worked, right? We've sent so many billions after chasing this, you know, Lucy holding this green football, that by now we should learn that it's just going to be pulled out from under us every single time. The process is always the same. You have governors like Kathy Hochul pass these bills that say we'll be carbon free by some year in the distant future. Then they go down this green road. Their friends get rich. Their campaign contributions go up. But so do all the rates for all the working families trying to pay their bills. And then they say, oh, shucks, we were totally wrong about that date, mostly because we pulled it out of thin air, but obviously because wind and solar don't work. We're going to need more of your tax dollars, but we'll pretend to be your friend for the next election year. I think New Yorkers are smarter than that. At least I really hope they are.
Well, the other thing that would strike me is you know, I've always joked that, you know, when somebody says, hey, I've got a restaurant I run, and they say, oh, well, what does the food taste like there? Oh, I don't know. I don't eat there. I wouldn't eat there on a bet. You know, that you say, well, hold on a second. When the Chinese are making us all those windmills and solar panels, what are they making it with? Well, they're making it with a combination of coal and nuclear. And you say, well, if they have solar panels and they got the best technology and they're manufacturing them to beat the band, why aren't they using this stuff if it's so good? And you say, because they understand that a modern industrial country, even though China still plays its role as a third world country, they are a modern industrial country that produces a lot of goods. They say, we can't run a country like that on wind and solar. We got to run it on coal and nuclear. Well, if you're using that, why are you sticking us with this other stuff? Because you'll buy it. That seems to be the reason.
It's almost like, and I don't know if this analogy would stick, but a politician who demands that public schools get more and more money and teacher unions get more and more money than they send their kids to private school,
yeah,
it's kind of like that, right?
That happens more often than you think.
It does. It absolutely does. And it's all about them pushing government product, right? Like the guy running for mayor at the biggest city in Kathy Hochul's state, who said that we should have government grocery stores, and everybody freaked out. And then we look at, well, then why do we have government mandating our electricity? Why do we have government mandating our schools? Well, it's just the next step in their manifesto of trying to control as much as they can for you and me and everyone listening, but of course not for them. The lights will stay on at their house.
And by the way, Larry, one of the things I've always hoped for is privately produced power, not by government, because it's kind of a mix across America of both private companies and others. But a long time ago, I found out about a company, I think it's called Aqua America. I've got no dog in the fight. I don't get any money from them. But I called them up, and they said, yeah, we supply water for about 12% of America. And the rest of America all gets its water from government. And it usually costs too much money. It doesn't have very efficient service. There's lots and lots of waste. So I wanted to know, how does this private company do it? They say, we have less waste. We're more efficient. We're more nimble. We're all these things. And I thought, why have we always accepted that all of our water comes from government agencies, when government agencies like the DMV and the Postal Service and Amtrak are so notoriously inefficient and badly run? That's Larry Behrens. Larry's with a group called Power the Future. Larry, thanks very much. So take note of that. When Kathy Hochul says, yeah, I'm for nuclear, just ask yourself whether or not that I'm for nuclear is going to last 1 minute past the election where she secures her re-election as governor of New York. Back in a moment. Glad to get your calls at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. We're seeing the...
No need to adjust your volume. He's just that loud. Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and we endeavor on a daily basis to serve the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk. This segment of the program is always brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medical specialists, Oregon Medical Centers. On our X poll today, should the government seize assets of illegal aliens who refuse to self-deport from the United States of America? I think that is a tremendous idea. And in fact, I've yet to have a naysayer take apart that idea. If you're here in this country illegally, if you have accumulated assets, if you owe the government money, then you should by all means pay it back. And if you're not willing to self-deport, and leave the country, then the government coming and taking your assets might just encourage you to do the right thing. Couple of things that I thought were great. Number one, in Seattle, the Seattle City Council yesterday approved a new piece of legislation at the city level that will allow civil penalties of up to $1,500 for every violation of what they call graffiti tagging, what I call vandalism of private property. I think it's a tremendous idea. Actually, I suggested that the city attorney, Ann Davison, love to get her on the show, but she's apparently fairly busy. I'd love to see her take these people to small claims court. And you say, well, most of them are young people who don't have much in the way of assets. That's all right. Just give a civil violation $1,500 and then tag that to their approval, say, to renew your automobile license, renew your driver's license, renew your professional licenses. And at that point, maybe even seize property in that case as well. $1,500 every time you get caught doing that kind of vandalism, it might help pay back some of the costs. Second issue, federal agents have now arrested some of the ICE protesters in Spokane, and they include former Spokane City Council President Ben Stuckert. Eight others have been indicted by a federal grand jury on charges related to the riots against ICE last month. In Spokane, Stuckert has been charged with conspiracy to impede or injure officers. I want to see this stuff happen because I want to see when there are city officials that say, we will go out and get in the way of ICE doing its job. Well, if you want to simply say we're not going to cooperate with ICE, that may be legal. Interfering with them, that becomes a federal crime, and that is a problem. Let's go to Patricia. Hey, Patricia, welcome to the program. What's on your mind on this fine Wednesday?
Hello, sir. Actually, it's my Friday, so it's kind of exciting.
Very good.
In regards to the federal government, absolutely.
Patricia, your phone's breaking up a little bit on me. I'm not sure where you are, whether your cell phone is near a window.
I'm talking too fast there. How's that? That better?
No, you're fine. You're fine. But you said you're in favor of that. I am too. Because
absolutely.
Somebody, yeah. Anything beyond that, Patricia?
Absolutely. Oh, because get them out of here. We have so many people right here in USA, veterans, elders, children. We need to be taking care of our own country. And that's it. We need to be taking care of our own country. I was a fortunate one that my ancestors came over from the Mayflower. Okay, great. So those that are less fortunate that you know, were born later in life or whatever, that are not of this country, then do it the proper way. They will receive more blessings if they do it the proper way.
Absolutely right. Patricia, thanks for the call. Let's go to Abraham. Abraham, welcome to the program. Hey, Abraham. You know, I thought Abraham wanted to have something to say, but apparently he doesn't. So, Abraham, thanks very much. 866, hey, Lars. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And watch for this story over about the next 24 hours. One of the most recent immigration arrests took place yesterday morning outside a preschool in Beaverton, and it appears to have been the first in the state to happen on school grounds. Although, let me point out right up front what the fish wrapper did not point out up front, and that is it happened at a private school called the Guidepost Montessori School, which is near Highway 217. The school serves young toddlers through kindergartners, according to its website. I tell you this as well, that Montessori schools cost money. They can often cost $800 or $1,000 every month. So you've got somebody who's an illegal alien, and if they're doing famously that job that Americans don't want to do, how is it that you're affording that kind of schooling for your child? Well, it turns out the parent who was stopped by immigration officers had just dropped off his child at the Guidepost Montessori. Now, I'm watching. Because I know that there are going to be people out there who don't like ICE, they don't like Donald Trump, they don't like the idea of telling illegal aliens they have to go home. And they're going to say, how dare they do this arrest at a school or a church or a hospital or a courthouse? And you make a long, long list. There are people out there who believe that in the mythology that somehow schools are sanctuary spaces, or churches are sanctuaries, or hospitals are sanctuaries. The fact is, if they are inside the United States, then U.S. law applies in those places. There are no places in which ICE cannot go in with probable cause and take someone into custody for being in the United States illegally. And if you think that is the case, it does not match with law. If you talk to the attorneys and ask them, is there any place in America that I can go if I'm an illegal alien and I will be safe from arrest? The answer is no. So what is my advice? If you're illegally in the United States, self-deport and come back legally if you choose to do so. Glad to be with you on a Wednesday. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.